Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the increasing risk of war between Russia and Ukraine and the rising cost to Russia of its annexation of Crimea. Daniel Serwa, a former U.S. Special Envoy for Yugoslavia who participated in the Dayton peace talks, joins us to discuss Putin's use of NATO intervention in the former Yugoslavia as justification for annexing Crimea and look into the mounting costs for Russia of taking on Crimea and possibly eastern Ukraine, as well as the cost to the U.S. and Europe of taking on what's left of Ukraine that has been looted economically and is deeply in debt. Then we'll look into the Obama administration's second attempt to crack down on for-profit colleges, who account for 13% of college enrollment but incur half of all federal student loan debts. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, where he has an article, Shame, Wall Street Journal compares rule for predatory colleges to Obamacare, joins us to discuss the gainful employment rule that will set rules to stop the misleading promises and expensive advertising by the for-profit college industry, which is paid for with taxpayer dollars, used to attract veterans and minority students, many of whom end up with worthless diplomas while being saddled for life with onerous debt. Then finally, on the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska, we'll speak with Shannon Moore, a progressive radio broadcaster in Anchorage, Alaska. She joins us to discuss the toxic legacy from millions of gallons of crude oil that fouled the pristine Prince William Sound, damaging more than 1,300 miles of shoreline and destroying the local fishing industry. We'll examine the likelihood of more oil spills as drilling is underway in the Arctic north of Alaska, where it will be all but impossible to clean up a spill in that challenging and remote environment. And joining me now is Daniel Serwa, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiations in the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He was also Vice President for Centers of Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace, and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He also blogs at peacefair.net. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Serwa.
My pleasure to be here.
And in terms of the confrontation between Russia and the West over Ukraine, having just annexed Crimea, and now a very real credible possibility that Russia will invade eastern Ukraine, obviously Putin in his speech recently to the Duma used Kosovo as an example of the West's double standard. Since you were involved in both the Bosnian War and later in what happened with Kosovo, you had something of an inside, a ringside seat there. What are the connections or analogies put forward by Putin and many of those who support Putin's position in the West?
Putin is trying to claim that he's entered Crimea to protect Russian speakers, but there's really very little merit in that claim. There have been virtually no mistreatment of Russian speakers in Crimea, and certainly nothing like the ethnic cleansing and killing that caused the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia.
And is there a possibility, though, that now that he's taken over Crimea, apparently key people like parliamentarians and the leading military officer have been disappeared along with a bunch of activists?
I think there's a very real risk that Putin, who's been playing this from Milosevic's playbook, will proceed to the next stage. And the next stage is for him to try to get rid of some of the Ukrainian speakers, and in particular the Tatars, who represent a threat to his hold on Crimea. So I don't think this is entirely over in Crimea, and I think there's some real risk of that we're going to see much worse behavior on the part of Moscow.
But apparently, I've talked to a number of people who were in Moscow at the time of the bombing of Milosevic and Serbia, And apparently there was genuine outrage amongst the Russian people. They really had.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, that there was genuine outrage. At the time, there was very little genuine outrage at the mistreatment of the Albanians, so it was a rather one-sided kind of outrage. And frankly, Russia, in the end, by allowing Resolution 1244 to pass, which ended the NATO-Yugoslavia war, de facto it approved the NATO intervention. It wasn't a legal approval, but it certainly surrendered its right to stand against what NATO did.
But Putin has cited this. Obviously, he just did so a few days ago at the Duma. He's also talked about how he felt that Russia got had over approving the UN resolution to intervene in Libya, which he felt NATO took advantage of, and that began his falling out with Medvedev, his protege. So, I mean, it's clear that Putin harbors these grudges, whether he's doing it for political purposes and for propaganda purposes, but it wouldn't work unless the Russian people felt this similar sense of humiliation that he articulates.
I think that's absolutely correct. It wouldn't work except for the populist support that it engenders. I think there's much more basis in historical fact for Putin's complaint about NATO behavior in Libya than there is about his claim that he's doing in Crimea what NATO did in Kosovo. If he really believed that, the logical consequence would be that Russia would recognize the independence of Kosovo, which it's certainly not preparing to do.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Serwer, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiations in the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He also was the Vice President for Centers of Peace Building Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace, and he is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he also blogs at peacefair.net. Now, it seems that, obviously there's this vote coming up now in Ukraine in May 25th, which is a key vote. And I spoke yesterday to a independent defense analyst in Moscow who believes that there's an 80% chance that Putin will invade. He put it at sometime around April the 15th. While Ukraine is weak and in disarray, he feels that Putin's going to strike. The last thing that Putin's going to accept is this election coming up in May that would permanently sever Ukraine from the Russian orbit. What's your sense on whether or not that's going to happen?
I think there's a good chance that it will happen. The big immediate problem Putin has created for himself by taking Crimea is that he's removed something like 1 million pro-Russian votes from the national polls in Ukraine. So it seems to me that the logic of the situation is that he should want to take more of Russian-speaking Ukraine, while, as you say, the Ukrainians are very weak. And it'll be a real test of NATO, of Europe, and of the United States to see whether they can find non-military ways, because I don't think there is any military way, to deter the Russians from moving against southern Ukraine, where, you know, the Russian interest is clearly not in the Russian speakers, but in the heavy industry, much of which works for Russian military manufacturing that happens to be located there.
So if Putin goes ahead with this, it obviously could end up as a major disaster. Presumably, he wants to repeat what he did in Crimea, where he can take a chunk of territory without firing a shot, in effect. It's not likely to work out quite so smoothly if he takes a big chunk of eastern Ukraine. And, you know, at that point, all bets are off, aren't they? I mean, this would be... What's your sense?
My sense is still that the West is not prepared and will not intervene directly militarily because it would be a very difficult intervention indeed. I think you're exactly correct that the Russians will face serious problems if they invade southern Ukraine. There are a lot of Ukrainians there. There are a lot of people who will resist. Crimea is actually quite unique in Ukraine in the degree of its allegiance to Russia, partly because it was part of Russia until 1954. That's not true of southern Ukraine, and I think he'd have a much more difficult time there. It won't be taken without a shot fired.
But if, obviously one's not suggesting the West go to war, because Russia has a substantial nuclear arsenal, and Ukraine is not a member of NATO. But it would seem, if you follow this through, that Putin, whether he's trying to distract the Russian people from his own kleptocracy and using patriotism, as, you know, this country went crazy over invading Iraq, the press and everybody drank the Kool-Aid, and national patriotic fervor was a high pitch in the United States prior to the invasion of Iraq that turned out to be one of the great political disasters in history, or geopolitical disasters in history. So you can't, obviously what's going on in Russia now is similar. But I take it, though, that at the end of the day, this is going to probably cost Putin and Russia a lot more than they'll gain if they get bogged down in a guerrilla war in Ukraine, if they take on the burden of Crimea without having the tourist revenue coming in there, and then if the Europeans wean themselves from Russian oil and gas, isn't at the end of the day Putin going to be the big loser?
Yes, but in the long term, of course, we're all dead. I think you're exactly right that Crimea will be more of a burden than the Russians anticipate right now. I think southern Ukraine would be an enormous burden to them and would cause a very dramatic reaction in Europe and in the United States. So, yes, Putin risks biting off far more than he can chew, but he wouldn't be the first leader to make a mistake as a result of domestic enthusiasm for what he was doing.
Well, that raises the question of the extent to which, as Angela Merkel said, he's not in the real world. That's what I find disturbing about this, is that he's...
Well, I would agree entirely. He seems to believe the propaganda of the Russian state-controlled media, in particular about the mistreatment of Russians in Ukraine. There's very little evidence for it at the moment. Admittedly, there have been some clashes, there have been some demonstrations that might cause a Russian speaker some concern, but there have been quite a few that might cause a Ukrainian speaker some concern as well. So it seems to me he has to be somebody among his advisors should be saying to them, look, you've done something that we can be happy with. Let's not overdo it. But he may overdo it. As I say, he wouldn't be the first leader to be carried away by the enthusiasm of his own population.
Well, one of his chief aides just the other day, referring to Putin as the boss, as they call him, said, in terms of Western sanctions against Putin and Russia, this aide said, you don't back the boss into a corner. That's a bad idea. That was his warning. Well, now the G7 have basically said that they're not going to go to the G8 conference in Sochi. So already they're putting Putin out in the cold. And Russia, again, is acting defiantly, so sanctions don't, water off the duck's back, if you will. So the attitudes, seem to be that the more that the West pushes back, the more Putin hardens his position.
Well, that's not a reason not to push back, however. Putin, so far as the G8 is concerned, has been a pretty useless affair all along. Even the G7 is pretty useless. The G20 is where important economic things happen today. They're using the G7 right now to send a message to Moscow, but I think much more important than G7, G8 is a consistent policy of strong support for the government in Kiev and getting them past this immediate crisis. They need to get to their election, and in order for that to happen, somehow the Europeans and the Americans have to send a strong enough signal to Putin that biting off southern Ukraine would be a serious mistake. I'm not entirely sure how you do that, but it does appear to me that in the long term, it's pretty clear that Russia will not benefit from taking anything more than Crimea. Even with Crimea, I don't expect the Americans or the Europeans ever to accept the annexation of Crimea. And that means that we face a long period of sanctions and other measures to try to correct the situation.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Serwer, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiations in the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He also was the Vice President for Centers of Peace Building Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace, and he is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he also blogs at peacefair.net. Well, we've dealt with the extent to which Putin, his victories may be short-lived, that Crimea may end up being a burden, and that it may also get ugly with ethnic cleansing against the Tatars, etc. And if he bites off eastern and southern Ukraine, then that may prove to be even more expensive. But on the other side, if the West is going to prop up and save Ukraine that's been looted by Putin's protege Yanukovych, then that's going to be a massive financial drain. I mean, they're broke, what, something like $80 billion in debt or something? I don't know.
Absolutely. Ukraine is going to be a big burden for the West. The IMF is already over quota. That is, it's loaned Ukraine more than it's supposed to already, and it's going to have to loan Ukraine more. The Europeans, who are fed up with basket cases because of Greece and Portugal and other problems they've had within the Eurozone, the Europeans aren't feeling generous, but they will do what they can. And the Americans, the legislation for some loan guarantees, last I heard, was still stalled in the Congress. So this is going to be a challenge, meeting the needs of Ukraine over the next couple of years, no matter how big or small Ukraine may be. It's going to be a burden. It's going to be a burden for Russia, and it's going to be a burden for the West. Be much better if we could come to some agreement that we'd all cooperate rather than compete. But I don't see any prospect of that at the moment.
Well, you were just telling me earlier, Daniel Serwer, that you're just back from Cuba, where that's been 50 or 60 years of how many presidents has Castro outlived? I can't remember that.
Well, he's outlived half a dozen presidents, but it's not quite 70 or 80 years.
No.
It's 55 years, I think, is the right count. But it's a Cuba, you know, I wanted to get there before communism fell, and I almost didn't make it. It's a very different Cuba from what it was a couple of decades ago. It's a Cuba that is running on a, mostly now on a convertible currency, which is driving a tremendous growth of entrepreneurialism and the private sector. The withering away of the state is happening, but it's not withering away towards some communist utopia. It's withering away under pressure from the Cubans' own capitalist instincts, which are very, very strong.
Well, I brought it up because I wanted to get a sense of, in terms of your work, in terms of peace building, is there at this point when things look so bleak, and the idea, I don't know whether you read the op-ed in Monday's New York Times by the former U.N. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, it's very bleak that we're entering a new Cold War, not the same as the old one, but, you know, if there was ever a relic of the Cold War, it's Cuba.
Certainly, Cuba is a relic of the Cold War. It's a state-controlled economy. Is that Fidel and Raul are ideologically relics of the Cold War? But frankly, I don't think there's any prospect that Cuba will survive. I think it's much more likely that there'll be a transition of some sort. The question is whether it's going to be an orderly one or a disorderly one. I don't think Russia's going to come in and save communist Cuba from the inevitable. Venezuela's been doing that in recent years, but Venezuela can't do it much longer either. So, you know, I think there, too, we're looking at something that... be careful what you wish for, because Cuba may end up being a big burden for the United States someday.
So just in closing then, back to, I brought Cuba up to suggest that if there's some optimism in terms of change in Cuba, there seems to be little to no optimism for change in Russia. It seems to be changing for the worse.
It is changing for the worse. It's not going back, however, to Soviet-style communism. It's very much a kind of crony capitalist society, and that's a fate that doesn't help countries to survive in the modern world. So, you know, as much as I dislike what Putin is up to, do I really think that he can restore some kind of one-party rule in Russia? Well, that will be up to Russians. He's certainly going to try, but I have my doubts that he's going to succeed.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Daniel Sower.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Sower, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiating the first agreement reached in the Dayton peace talks. He's also was the Vice President for Centers of Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace, and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he also blogs at peacefair.net. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Obama administration's second attempt to crack down on for-profit colleges.